The following podcast was recorded live in the Van Pelt Dietrich Library Center of the University of Pennsylvania Libraries on June 14, 2007. The panel discussion was hosted in conjunction with the exhibition entitled Equus Unbound, Fairman Rogers and the Age of the Horse, which examines the expanding role of the horse in 19th century industrial America, highlighting materials from the Fairman Rogers collection of books on the horse and equitation. Participating panelists include Herb and Ellen Molis, thoroughbred horse breeders and owners of Candyland Farm, Dr. Dean W. Richardson, the Charles W. Raker Professor of Equine Surgery and Chief Section of Surgery at the New Bolton Center of the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine, Douglas Kemmerer, an active member of the Coaching Club and the Four in Hand Club, and a participant in the creation of long-distance drives in America over the last 15 years. The panel discussion is moderated by Dr. Ann Green, exhibit curator and lecturer in the Department of History and Sociology of Science at the University of Pennsylvania. She is author of the forthcoming book, Harnessing Power, Industrializing the Horse in 19th Century America.
Good evening. My name is Carton Rogers. I'm the Vice Provost and Director of Libraries here at Penn. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you to tonight's event and, to, of course, to the exhibit down the hall, Equus Unbound, Fairman Rogers and the Age of the Horse. We have a wonderful panel here tonight, two of whom, on my left, Herb and Ellen Molis, are great friends of the library and have been for many years. Herb actually was one of the original board members when the Library Board of Overseers was established. And somehow after that experience, he was still able to talk Ellen into joining the board, and she's a current member. They're wonderful friends of the library, and I'm always very pleased to have them with us. When I was asked if I would like any kind of formal role tonight, I told my colleagues that I would be very happy to play host, to pay for anything that might be associated with tonight's event, but that I probably wasn't the right person to kick off an event where people would discuss their passion for horses. It's not that I'm dispassionate about horses. It's just that I haven't had a lot of direct contact with them over the course of my life. In fact, the last time I was on a horse was probably, and I may be cutting some years off of this, but 40 years or so ago, one set of grandparents had a side hill farm in western New York State, and they always had a horse or two around. And occasionally, my grandfather would let me get up on one of the horses, although he always considered me to be his city slicker grandson because I lived, 40 miles, or not quite 40 miles, maybe 20 miles outside of Schenectady, New York, which, as you know, is a major metropolis. And he was very skeptical about my ability to get on that horse, get off the horse, without killing myself or doing damage to the horse. And even worse, when I did get up on the horse, I had the sense that the horse knew that I didn't really want to be on its back, and I thought that was more of a problem. I did, however, spend a lot of time in Saratoga, so I don't know if that gives me some credibility among the horse set. I hung around the racetrack for a lot of years growing up. And in all seriousness, you didn't really have to be intimately involved in the racing environment to get a sense of the majesty and beauty and grace of the horses. As a librarian, however, I am passionate about great collections, and the Fairman Rogers collection is an extraordinary accumulation of books about racing, about horses, about horse breeding, and so on. And I'm thrilled that it's part of the many wonderful collections that we have here at the university. Some of you probably know, and maybe you'll hear about this later, the collection originally was at the New Bolton facility in the small library out there, but was brought to this library a few years ago so that we could better maintain and care for the collection. So really all I'm here to do is to welcome you, and I do welcome you. I thank you for coming out tonight. I hope you enjoy the evening. You'll hear more about the way the evening is going to play out after a while. But one of the things we are going to do, we're going to show you some things that aren't in the exhibit downstairs, and I'm really looking forward to seeing those things as well. One of the great things about being a library director is that you see a wide range of materials that never make its way out to the public generally, so it's pretty exciting. Tonight's moderator is the curator of the exhibition, Anne Green. Anne is undergraduate coordinator and lecturer in the Department of History and Sociology of Science here at Penn. She received her BA in history from Brown, no booing, please, and her PhD in American history from Penn with a specialty in 19th century environmental and technological history. Her forthcoming book, Harnessing Power, Industrializing the Horse in 19th Century America, which will come out in 2008 from the Harvard University Press, examines the role of horses in the Industrial Revolution. In the course of her work, Anne has spent many, many hours working with material from the Fairman Rogers collection. She was the perfect person to curate the exhibit and is the perfect choice to be tonight's moderator. Please join me in welcoming Anne Green.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. The theme of our presentations tonight is what it means to have a passion for horses and the different ways that that has led us into different ways of relating to horses, different activities around horses in our lives. I'm going to talk very briefly about horses in the 19th century and about Fairman Rogers and the collection. And then I'll answer the question myself, and then we will move on to, I will introduce our panel members and have them speak. In fact, I'm going to introduce them now that I think you've already been introduced to the Molises and Dean Richardson and Douglas Kemmerer, who is going to talk to us about coaching. You're head of the coaching, the Four in Hand Club. Yes. So we have a variety of perspectives on the horse business. Horses and humans have been living and working together for 6,000 years. And in that 6,000 years, they have changed each other substantially. One thing that has stayed fairly consistent, as far as I can see across a number of centuries, though, is what the meaning of horses has been in human culture. And I think it plays out in some different ways, but horses usually symbolize some kind of power to people. Now, this may mean that they symbolize natural power. They may embody the face of nature to people. Or they embody natural forces. They represent natural forces. Spirituality, they've been important animals in various religions. Sexuality, both male and female. Certainly physical strength, the physical force of nature. Another way, of course, the kind of power that they symbolize is military strength. And in the exhibit, I quoted a wonderful passage from Job that describes the war horse. And if you are conversant in the Old Testament, you know that whenever they talk about the horse, they mean the army. They mean the power of a monarch. And certainly the symbol of the man on the horse as a leader has been strong right up into the 20th century. In fact, it was a bit of a problem when William Howard Taft, 300 and some pounds, just couldn't get on a horse, that there were people who were upset that he couldn't properly review troops from a carriage instead of on the back of some poor, suffering horse trying to carry his 300-plus pounds, because they felt that it was important for the leader to have that association. Third, of course, horses have signified a high class and wealth. They've been aristocratic symbols and symbols of riches for a long time. Fourth, horses have come to symbolize tradition, not only the notion of horse breeds and pedigrees, but also they tend to symbolize the past. What phrase do we use for talking about the past? We say, well, horse and buggy days. And fifth, I think, as we saw with Barbaro, horses also symbolize character. They have long been symbols of what was called sagacity, wisdom, strength, determination, good character. And we saw that come out very powerfully last year. Now, historians have generally emphasized all the different ways that horses got replaced by industrial technology. If there's one word that I always see near horse, it's obsolete. You know, always hearing about all the different ways that progress made horses obsolete, a position which I generally reject, but we'll get on to that. They overlook the fact that between 1820 and 1920, the horse became more important, not less important. The federal census found about 4 million horses in 1840, the first year they counted horses. By 1900, there were 24 million horses and 27 million by 1920. And that figure stays pretty steady into the late 1920s. So you don't see a significant decline until the mid-1930s. The horse population grew 50% faster than the human population in the 19th century. And no, it was not the cowboy horses on the Western Plains. The horses were by and large concentrated in the most industrialized portions of the nation, in the Northeast and in the upper Midwest, in and around the cities. So in the 19th century, we see that horses are used more widely than ever before. We see that equine technologies change in order to use horses more widely and more efficiently. And we also see that horses change themselves, and horse breeds are created. Now, what causes this explosion is, in fact, all the things that we associate with industrialization. Railroads, mechanized agricultural equipment, and the mass production not only of that equipment, but of things like wagons and carriages and horseshoes and harness, which brought the price of using horses down and made it more accessible to more people. Horses were absolutely indispensable to the nation. They were the only self-propelled all-terrain machine around. They powered stagecoaches, streetcars, ferries, plows, reapers, combines, mining cars, canal boats, cranes, machines, carts, wagons, trucks, carriages, and capstans. Until 1880, the majority of all the power consumed by Americans comes from work animals. And by the 1880s, that means about 90% of those animals are horses. Or horses and half horses, meaning mules. Now, one consequence then are changes in the horses themselves, because people start breeding horses for specialized jobs. And starting the years after the Civil War, you begin to see mention of specific breeds that we would recognize. Whereas before, people talked about horses in regional terms, and they start talking about breeds. There's a widening array of horse breeds, horses being imported for breeding, and each breed has an association that defines the breed characteristics and polices the pedigree system. Another consequence for horses are changes in technology and knowledge, better design of vehicles, machines, and roads to reduce friction, to improve traction, and to reduce the draft of equipment and wagons, the use of agricultural chemistry to try to figure out what the best fuel for the equine machine would be, and establishment of veterinary schools to improve the care of horses. The first, of course, is Penn, founded in 1884, and one of the longest established vet schools in the United States. So it's in this context that I want to think about Fairman Rogers. Now, Rogers was born in Chester County, graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Penn in 1853 at the age of 20. By 22, he was on the university engineering faculty, where he taught until 1871. He married into the Shippen family of Philadelphia. At age 24, he was named to the American Philosophical Society. During the Civil War, he served with the Pennsylvania militia and saw battle at Antietam and Gettysburg, and was part of the very important survey of the Potomac River. In 1863, he was one of the first 50 members named to the new National Academy of Science. After 1871, he was a trustee of Penn and a co-founder of the School of Veterinary Medicine. He was a member of the Academy of Natural Sciences, president of the Horticultural Association, and a director of the Academy of Fine Arts. He founded the Rose Tree Hunt Club, brought polo to the United States in the 1870s, and was a renowned expert in the difficult art of driving a four-in-hand coach, and was perhaps the first person to do so in the United States. He wrote a manual of coaching, which I understand has never gone out of print, a book which blends engineering, aesthetics, and love of working with horses. Now, Fairman Rogers, as far as I can see, was a Renaissance man. He was interested in, I think, just about everything. I'm still trying to find it stuff he wasn't interested in. He was interested in engineering, science, magnetism, horticulture, landscape architecture, mechanical invention, fine art, human and veterinary medicine, education, surveying, photography, steam engines, and yachts. And, of course, horses and horse sports, hunting, steeplechasing, racing, coaching, and polo. And in many ways, his interest in horses overlapped with most of his other interests. For example, he commissioned Thomas Eakins to paint A May Morning in the Park, a painting based on the photographic techniques of Edward Muybridge, and then later he brought Muybridge to Penn, where he did most of his work. Fairman Rogers might be surprised to find that the 19th century horse world has been largely forgotten by historians, but his collection allows us to begin to reclaim and rediscover it. So, how did I get into this? Well, I grew up in Wisconsin, where my family owned a large dairy company and a number of farms. And so my earliest memories are of a world of work, a world of muscle, a world of animal muscle, human muscle, and machine muscle. I remember all of these mixed in with the smells of hay, manure, and machine oil. I remember a lot of mud. I've been a rider and a horse owner. My next project is learning how to drive. I got interested in horses during my doctoral work because I kept looking for my world in history, and I couldn't find it. And I would mention animals and get blank looks or laughter. And as I worked on I began pursuing this idea about horses more. It led me into environmental and technological history, and I discovered that few historians had written about horses or even considered them to be important. Fortunately, things are changing. Animal history is on the rise. I have more and more colleagues every year who go to conferences and talk about animals. I am no longer the only horse lady at academic conferences. So I stay with this subject because it makes me think about the way that we are embedded in the world and the many layers of relationships that we have with the world, about our connections to the natural world through our technological relationships and the way that our relationships with animals are part of that, part of a dense social world that we live in. I see animals as fellow inhabitants, co-workers, partners, I like many kinds of animals. I appreciate animals, or horses in particular, for their particular style of being, their style of living, and the way that they relate to humans and others. And now, to pick up on this question, we're going to go to our other people. Which one of you would like to talk first?
I think he should, because he'll talk about the farm. I'd still be living on Fifth Avenue, far away from the farm, and it's up to me. So let him go first.
Okay.
You want this?
Yeah, get that out of your way.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is Herb Molis. Let me start this way. I grew up in Brooklyn. I lived in New York my younger years. I then went to the University of Pennsylvania, the Wharton School. I then worked in New York for another 30 years. So the only horses I ever saw were the police horses that chased us out of the park when we were kids. And Carton actually goes one step beyond me. He's been on the back of a horse once. I've never been on. And let me just explain, though, how I got involved and what I do now. When I went to Penn, a couple of the classes were rather boring, and I used to sit with the Strout Realty catalog. In today's world, I guess if you wanted to buy a farm, you would go on Google and put in horse farms in Mid-Atlantic area or whatever, and you'd get all the information. In those days, you didn't. You went to books. And Strout Realty, I don't know if anybody here knows what that was, but it was a catalog where you bought 4,000 acres in Kansas for about $2,000 total. Where the land was, I don't know. But I dreamed of this idea that someday I would live on a farm. Never knew what I would do on a farm. I said, you know, I really don't want to grow corn or tomatoes or anything like that. And then something happened in my life where I sold a business and I was dealing with some Irish attorneys from Ireland, who were very much into horses. And they convinced me to buy a racehorse with them. Well, all of a sudden it clicked. I said, you know, that's terrific. I enjoy sports. I was always into sports and all of that. And I said, this would be a lot of fun to do on a farm. So one day I said to Ellen, well, let's go take a ride and down to the Pennsylvania, you know, Delaware, Maryland area. She said, well, what are we taking a ride down there for? I said, well, we'll look at some farms. She said, farms? Now, you have to understand, Ellen has never been out of high heels in her life. She ran, she was president of a real estate management company in New York and went from being a 15-year-old secretary to becoming the president. And from the day I knew her, I never saw her out of heels. So she comes down to, we go down to drive down, we find this, look at a couple of farms, and she's still looking at me like I'm nuts. But you wouldn't believe it, but we bought a farm that day. And as we drove back, I said to Ellen, this has got to be the dumbest thing we ever did. But we, the horse to us was just a beautiful, beautiful animal. Many things have been said about it, but to me, it's the whole movement of the horse that just got to me and that I just admired so. From that day that we bought the farm, we said, well, my Wharton education taught me, don't go into racing. That can't be a profitable venture. You're not crying, are you? Ellen cries at the drop of a hat, so understand that. My Wharton education told me, don't go into racing. That makes no sense whatsoever. And the thing that appealed to me, to both of us most, was the breeding. We studied books. We studied. We read every magazine there was to be read. I had a very good friend who was a very good pedigree analyst, and he helped us with that, with pedigrees. And basically, the breeding of horses, whether it be warm bloods or thoroughbreds or whatever, is a lot of pedigree and just the look of a horse. You know, you sort of get the feel for looking at different stallions, and you know your mares, and you know, you sort of get what goes with what. It's like playing God, quite frankly, which makes it an awful lot of fun. Now, you know, you sort of get your pedigrees together. Now you have to get the mare in foal, and this requires not the easiest, it's not the easiest procedure, not the actual procedure. I mean, the procedure is what we all know, you have a baby. But the idea of getting the mare ready, sending it to the stallion at the right time. So it requires a good reproductive vet. And the gestation period is 11 months, so that the poor mare is in foal, then she foals a baby, and 2 weeks later she's back in the breeding shed. And go tell your wife that this is the way the world works, and she says, no, you got to skip a year. And you say, no, you don't skip the year. So in any event, the breeding operation is something that we both enjoy. There's nothing like seeing, a mare foal. It's just a joy of life. It's nature. The horse is really a microcosm of nature and of life. You see this baby born, you bring the baby up, you now wean the baby from the mare, and which is, you know, not a pleasant process, but you know it's the evolution of what goes on. And then whether you race or breed and sell, we generally at our farm breed and sell, but you have to be prepared to race, because if you don't get the price you think you should get, then you do race. And to watch this little foal just grow into a yearling, and then to see him race as a, you know, a 2 or 3 or 4 year old, and it's just you know, and then become another mare later on, or hopefully a stallion, is just the whole life cycle is done in a very short period of time. I mean, we have 10 grandchildren, and it's taken 20 years to, you know, they're first in college now. By the way, 3 of them are here at Penn. It just takes a long time with horses. You know, it's just quicker, and it's very enjoyable. Whether it's profitable, I'd say the lifestyle that we're getting from it makes it worthwhile, but whether we've made money at it, I really can't say. I'll call it breaking even. And this is what it's all about. Now, when the horse is finished with their racing career, we then set up an organization to take care of them in their later years, and I'll let Ellen tell you a bit more about that. But that's basically the way we got into it. Our passion is for horses, and we enjoy the breeding aspect of it most of all. If there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer it, or we'll go on from there, and Ellen will go to the next step. Ellen?
Well, I have to defend myself, because in the beginning, I never dreamed of a farm. I didn't have a passion for a farm. I love animals, but a horse was sort of an unknown thing to me, except maybe in Central Park. And when Herb did say, let's go find a farm, I thought, is he out of his mind? But that was 21 years ago. We have the farm 21 years. And I'll tell you, I cannot picture living anywhere else but on the farm. Can't picture living without horses. and without the animals that we have surrounding us. It's just a wonderful, wonderful life. And when you find a passion for something, it just makes your life so much more rewarding and fulfilling. When we started 21 years ago, and Herb said, you know, we have a farm now, we have to learn to do everything there. Even though we're going to have people doing the work, we still have to learn how to do it. So I learned how to muck a stall. I did take my high heels off. I got tennis shoes. And by the way, I'm not in heels very often because they're much more comfortable. But we mucked stalls. We painted fences. We have white fencing. And white fencing, as you know, must be maintained. So we do a lot of painting. We did. We planted alfalfa, so we did hay, drove a tractor, we baled hay. And also, I went through life, my earlier years, saying, I don't sweat. The reason I thought I didn't sweat, of course, you're in an air-conditioned car. You go to an air-conditioned office. You go to an air-conditioned meeting. You go to an air-conditioned restaurant. So I didn't sweat, and I never worked. Well, when I was doing hay, I was sweating. I said, no, it's no, there is nothing like it. But we did it all, and we enjoyed it. When we started, I said, let's go. We had a farm. We have a farm about a mile and a half from ours in Chesapeake City, where Northern Dancer was standing. And Northern Dancer was probably the greatest, at that time, the greatest sire that was around. I think he got something at the peak of his career. I think he was getting $1 million for one breeding right to a mare. So I said, I must see Northern Dancer. So we went over the mile and a half, visited Northern Dancer. He had a beautiful stall. He had a beautiful paddock. He had a gorgeous bronze plaque, Northern Dancer, and he would be in there and was wonderful. I then wanted to see Kentucky, so we went to where Secretariat was, and Secretariat also, a gorgeous, gorgeous stallion, and he had this incredible paddock, his name was on it, and so on, and I thought that that's the way horses were taken care of when they no longer were racing. One evening, Herb and I are sitting in front of the fire, it was wintertime, and he said, oh, you have to read this article by this incredible business horsewoman, Alaire DuPont. And he gives me the article to read, and of course he did say that I cry very easily. Well, I was sobbing through this thing. I had to put it down many times because I couldn't get through it for my tears. And she was talking about what happens to the average racehorse. The fact that when a horse could no longer run fast enough to win a race or was injured, they would be put onto these trucks and shipped to New Holland to like an auction place, and the butchers would come in and they would bid $500 or $600 for the horses, and they would kill them and sell them for meat. At times, horses were just left in stalls at racetracks. They would close the doors, not feed them, not take care of them, and until somebody found them starving, literally starving, or dying or dead or whatever. When I finished reading the article, the two of us looked at each other and we said, well, we have to do something about this. We can't allow this to go on. There's a responsibility that people who have horses must recognize. So we called Alaire, and Alaire DuPont became our very, very closest and dearest friend for many, many years until she passed away 2 years ago. And the three of us sat and said, what are we going to do? How can we raise funds? How can we do something to help people to put horses into retirement or find second careers for them or get them adopted out? But we have to do something. And actually, those discussions gave birth to Thoroughbred Charities of America, which is an organization, a non-for-profit organization that is now entering its 18th year. We determined we had to raise funds. How do we go about it? And we would contact the people who had horses, and we would convince them that it's time to give back. It's time to help the horse help the horse. And what would we do? We would ask for stallion seasons, which is a breeding right to a stallion. And we'd say, give us one breeding right to that stallion. We will put it into our auction. We'll have an auction once a year. We'll put that stallion season into auction. And we contacted a number of artists and people in the area to get them to donate some artwork, some bowls, something that we could auction off at a silent auction. We had our first auction, which was held in our house at Candyland Farm in Delaware. We had 50 people that came. I made all the food. I rolled little meatballs, 300 or 400 meatballs, sausages and peppers, and that sort of thing. We had a cocktail party. And these people came, and we had the auction, and we raised $25,000. And we thought, well, that's pretty good for a start. Since then, we have increased the attendance. We have graduated to tents, large tents on the farm, sit-down dinners. Finally, we reached an attendance of 400 people at a sit-down dinner, and we raised $2 million. We now have a board of directors of 18 people. They're prominent people in the industry from all over the country. They're from Virginia. They're from Kentucky. These are our board members, New York, New Jersey, and, of course, Maryland and Delaware. We have our meeting in May of every year, and we review grant applications that are received by us from people who are looking for grants. They're from nonprofit organizations that we check out. We get their 990 tax return. We get two letters from veterinarians attesting to the fact that they run a good operation. They are either involved with retiring horses or finding second careers for horses or adopting them out. We have expanded the grantees to incorporate backstretch workers for scholarship programs, medical programs, child care facilities at racetracks where people working in the backstretch can leave their young children, medical facilities such as New Bolton, Grayson Foundation, Gluck Institute in Kentucky, and scholarships for children of farm workers. And all of these organizations, which now total approximately 200 organizations that we fund every year and that rely upon us for this funding to stay in existence. Our mission statement is to provide a better life for thoroughbreds both during and after their racing careers and by supporting retirement, rescue, and research and by helping the people who work with them. Last year, for the first time, we held the auction in Kentucky, and the reason for that was that most of the seasons, and the very, very important seasons, that's the stallion breeding rights, are given to us by Kentucky farms because that's where all the major stallions stand. And they, for the past number of years, these Kentucky farms have been saying to us, you know, you hold the auction in Delaware, which is great, it's been growing, but, you know, it's about time that you recognize that all of these stallions are coming from Kentucky, and you should really give us a chance to have the auction in Kentucky. So last year, for the first time, we had the auction at Keeneland Entertainment Center. The facility was donated to us by the Keeneland people. And Fazek Tipton, the auctioneers who have for many, many years handled our auction, agreed to do it at Keeneland, although they are competitors and they really don't do anything together, but they did it for this particular cause. And we had approximately 500 people in attendance. We exceeded the $2 million mark. We reached approximately $2,300,000. And we have just had our board meeting a week and a half ago, at which time we granted out all of the proceeds. We're very proud to say that 94 cents of every dollar that we receive goes to the grantees. That's a fact that no one else in the charity, you know, fundraising business can possibly say. And we're very, very proud of it. We have a dedicated group. We work very, very hard on it, but it's so full of passion, and everyone involved with it is so full of passion, and that's what makes it work. And we're entering our 18th year, and we're proud of it. and a lot of horses have been saved as a result of it. Thank you.
I'm Dean Richardson. I'm a chief of surgery out at New Bolton Center. And I guess, you know, being asked to speak here tonight pretty much confirms my suspicion that I'm getting really old for two reasons. One is that the Fairman Rogers collection is an antique book collection. And second, I'm on a program with Herb Mollis. So, you know, that's pretty much proof right there. It's interesting. That I was asked to talk here because, in fact, I know the Fairman Rogers collection quite well because I found it very quickly after I came to New Bolton Center in 1979 when it was still housed out there. And I am, I guess, what you would call a hippophilic bibliophile, which is a sesquipedalian manner of saying I like horse books. But it sort of started – I mean, the only reason I ended up becoming a vet is because I actually took horseback riding for a physical education credit when I went to college. And I changed my career plans from being a really poor actor to becoming a moderately successful veterinarian. But once I got into horses, I got into it very seriously. And I literally read, I think, every book at Dartmouth College in the Baker Library on horses and horsemanship. And I include all the antique books and then when I came to Penn, I looked extensively. I had to do other things, unfortunately, but I did go through the Fairman Rogers collection and was really fortunate to be able to have access to it when it was still out there. One thing about that that collection, though, that really makes you think about some deeper issues, actually, as a veterinarian, when you look at all the, I guess, sort of the certainties in some of those old books about science and, or for that matter, about horsemanship, about veterinary medicine, about horsemanship, and you kind of it puts it in perspective, and you think, well, you know, are our successors in the distant future going to think we're just as big a bunch of bozos? Probably that's the case, but the when you look at these old books, it's really it does put it in perspective how things change but stay the same. I mean, you look at things like the various books on podology and on shoeing and farriery, and realize, in fact, you know, how little that changed for so long and how much controversy still exists on what a horse's foot should look like. If you're really into horses, you recognize that even something as obvious as what should a horse's foot look like still gets argued about to an extraordinary degree, really. So I really think that it's, that when you look at it, at old books like that, and it's a superb collection of old books, it should at least make you think of your own place in history, even if it hasn't become history just yet, and make you doubt how certain you are about so many things. I mean, there's so many great books in this collection that you'll see if you look at it. Certainly everybody has their favorites. I mean, for me, it's hard not to love the Stubbs book, which, I don't know if it's still, does anyone know if the Stubbs exhibition is still at the Frick? If you go to New York, there's currently a Stubbs, George Stubbs exhibition at the Frick, and it's a small collection of his work, but again, those of you who are into horse art, that's where it started, basically, was with George Stubbs learning anatomy and basically doing the first sort of extraordinarily beautiful work of anatomical art. It's really a remarkable piece. And if you read more about the history of it, it also makes you appreciate the fact that when he was doing that, that was pre-refrigeration days. And he used to have equine cadavers on the second floor of the building where he was doing his work, and they describe things as being somewhat malodorous at times until I guess that's when he started to get to the deeper layers of his anatomical dissections. But as a surgeon, I certainly really appreciate that particular book. But there's so many books in the collection that are just absolutely marvelous. you know, you ask how to, you know, I got, it's hard. I'm so far into horses now at this stage in my life that it's, you know, it's almost, you know, laughable to think about life without horses. So for me to go back and try to remember back when I wasn't interested in horses is difficult. But it really was true. I didn't know anything about horses for the first 16, 17 years of my life at all. Nothing whatsoever. But once you get into them, you can really get into them. And one thing you do learn, now that, you know, we're talking about things you learn about horses. I mean, phrase that I use frequently is that horses are always on your side. But what I mean by that is they're either intent on suicide or homicide. That's the those are the sides that they're on. If you do what I do for a living, you recognize that that's the case. And since we're in a library, I got to, you know, and I'm sort of a, you know, an academic, pointy-headed academic type. We're in a library. It'd be kind of foolish not to at least acknowledge one of the best phrases that I think was ever written about a horse, and of course it was by none other than Will Shakespeare. And it's just great because it has so much Shakespeare in it in terms of the puns and everything else. But from Henry V, it goes, "When I bestride him, I soar. I am a hawk. He trots the air. The earth sings when he touches it. The basest horn in his hoof is more musical than the pipe of Hermes. He is pure air and fire." It's just a great, it's a real great description of a horse. It's got the great Shakespearean puns. If you're a horse person and you think about the horn of the hoof, and then he goes at the pipe of Hermes, it's a great, great line. Now, you know, you could also then, you know, segue to W.C. Fields or somebody like that who basically said that what compromises horse sense is that horses are smart enough not to bet on people. So, yeah. All right, thank you for your attention.
I'm honored to be here. I'm Douglas Kimmer. I guess I'm the last hitter here, and I'm the kind of the sole only horseman. I don't have an intellectual background, and I certainly have never bred any horses or raised them. That seems to be far too complicated. Number one, Philadelphia is really an appropriate place to honor Fairman Rogers. Today, of the 25 active coaches in America, 10 of those are in the Philadelphia area. Modern coaching as we know it was really brought to by Frolic Weymouth, George A. Weymouth, who is the head of the founder of the Brandywine Museum, and Jack Seabrook. Phyllis Wyeth, who is the wife of Jamie Wyeth, and from a local family, a DuPont family here, is a four-in-hand driver despite her handicaps. She has shown recently at various of her drives, and we have a second of our largest drives ever in America coming up this fall in Middleburg, where I live, where we're expecting over 30 coaches, and she will be part of that. I won't go through all the names, but many of those show up, whips show up at Devon, and many of you have been at Winnetour, I'm sure. Frolic has had upwards to 70 carriages there, and I believe 17 or 18 coaches at various times. I'd like to give just a little bit of a history of where this coaching came from, but first let me tell you what a coach is. A coach is descendant of a commercial vehicle from England. It will handle anywhere from 12 to 14 people on top. It is usually equipped with boxes full of librations and food. It weighs about 5,000 pounds fully loaded. It requires four horses to pull it, and it requires at least two horses to help stop it. The brakes will not stop a coach. They'll stop maybe half a coach. I don't know what it is. Going down steep hills, I can tell you I've contemplated what it is. But those two-wheelers have got to hold back the coach. So you are the horses now. The horses don't pull a coach, by the way. The horses push a coach. They push against the collar, and they have to lean into it. And if you can imagine having four unwieldy children trying to get them to do the same thing at the same time, that's a little bit handling a coach and four. You've got 4,000-pound animals out there, and sometimes they do not all want to do the same thing. The horses are not trained to do automatically. They're trained to listen to you, much like a roper's horse is trained to stay between the roper's legs. It's the roper that tells where the horse to go. It's the same thing with a coach and four. Whips are a different case. There is no doubt about it. We are a strange group. Somebody once said that Lord lined up everybody and the people were standing in the back. He says, I'm going to damn you people, make you horsemen. And the people way back, he made them coachmen. There's obviously not many of us are doing it. At the turn of the century, there were about 25. And today we have 25. It's not a sport that has grown too much. And that tells you something about it. One of your more esteemed coachmen from Philadelphia was killed driving a coach and four at probably too fast a speed. A route in Rittenhouse Square, which is somewhat different, difficult, as you know, because it is square. It did happen at midnight, and supposedly there was a band on board at the time. I tried to find the name of the chap. I couldn't. It was Mary Cassette's cousin, and some here everybody may know of him, the chap. He was described by his wife at the funeral as every day was July 4th to him, and every night was New Year's Eve. He sounds like a fun type, and I tell you, I don't think that the coachmen today have parted too much from that. It is not a hobby. It is a way of life. We talked here about what none of us here can imagine being without horses. I will tell you, being a coachman is a way of life. There is no question about it. It transformed my life totally. I moved back here from California. I was involved in horses. I did not drive carriages. I was sane at that time. And I got involved in coaching, and so it is obviously my downfall started then. I got into horses late in life. I was a sailor and a skier, and I had no interest in horses. I had no familiarity with them, and I don't know what ever possessed me, but I decided to get a couple of horses, and one thing took off. It took off big time. I was a Western rider. I was doing roping. I got involved. I saw the fox hunt go by, and I said, wow. And I became a fox hunter, a polo player. Then I got involved in endurance riding and the ride and tie and realized I knew almost nothing about horses. I went to every clinic that I could find, University of California at Davis, Fort Collins, Cornell. Didn't ever made it to U of P. I don't know why, but I got to those others. Philadelphians were too erudite. I was the image or something. How did coaching as a sport get started? Well, let's go back. Coaching was a way of transporting people and goods in England. Probably started 1680, somewhere like that, the earliest readings I found. It became a refined entity about 1750. The Royal Mail coaches came into being. The roads that they were used were the old Roman roads. It leads to a major piece of trivia. As you may know, the railroads in this country are 4'8". Wide. The reason they are is that they were copied from the original rail cars from England. The original rail cars in England were that width because the horse-drawn carts were that width, and the reason they were is because the Roman roads had troughs built where the wheels went, and they were from the Roman carriages. The official distance, according to Caesar's decree, to cover the asses of two horses was 4'8". And that even today has determined the width of our space shuttles because they are transported on the railroads. We did not have roads in America like England did, and so England was where coaching was. In 1831, 1,000 coaches left London every morning. They were the fax, they were the internet, they were the telephone, they were the television of the day. They took not only parcels and packages and people, they took the news from England. Up until the time coaching became popular, England didn't even have one language. Things were called differently at different times. They did not have common time. The time was set when the sun went over the local courthouse. Because they started having coaching scheduling, they needed something like common time. We didn't get common time in America until the railroads really forced it in 1870. The coaches... A lot of our terminology comes from that period. A term that we all associate with high-speed motorways, turnpike, came from the days when they had to develop local entities to improve the roads in England so that the carriages and coaches could pass by during the spring and fall when the roads were muddy. And so they developed toll roads. And the toll taker's job was to turn the pike or to turn the pole and to take the fee for passing. The term nodding off had dire consequences. It was a coaching term. If you fell asleep on top of the coach and nodded off, you oftentimes were badly hurt. Nightmare that many of us say we have actually came from coaching. The worst horses were put on the coaches at night when people couldn't see them, and they were called nightmares, the worst. So a lot of our history actually comes from those days. The first railroad train left Victoria Station in 1831, and coaching started a long demise, ending public coaching really probably 1850, 1860. The only coaching left in those days were going from the most outer point train stations in England to another little hamlet. But as we know it, it was no longer a commercial venture. But when it was a commercial venture, it was quite a thrill for the wealthy people to be able to bribe the coachman to take the ribbons, as they called them, or to take the reins. After coaching ended as a commercial enterprise, they had all these wonderful coaches around, and people started taking it up as a private sport. Coaching Club in America was formed in 1884. Fairman Roger was one of the original founders of it and has continued on today, but it had a great dry spell. In 1918, the Coaching Club did its last long-distance drive. It was not fun anymore. There were things called cars belching and smoking on the... And I forgot to turn off my phone. And I don't quite know how to do that, quite frankly. So we'll just have to let it play out. Because if I open it up, it'll answer, and then somebody will think it's my... and it's my wife calling to boot. So that's very typical. Matter of fact, my wife gave me a great line before I came here tonight. She said, and remind them that it takes a very committed wife to help you in this sport. And she says, one that quickly, eventually will become committed. She said, that's not funny. So I said, well, I think they may think it is. Where was I before my phone call? We were talking about, where was I? Help me out.
The cars on the road.
The cars on the road. And that became the end of the last coaching drive for the Coaching Club was actually out to Long Island from New York City. And our Coaching Club then became a polo club and then was revived by Jack Seabrook. And we now have a number of coaching members. I love long-distance events. When I got involved in horses, I got involved in the 100-mile event ride in California we have called the Davis Cup. I did it a number of times and earned my buckles and also at the time became involved in the organization and then became one of the founders of something, another crazy event called the Ride and Tie, which is a 40-mile event. When I got involved in coaching and reading all the history, and I think it's interesting, a number of us involved in horses, you will find, do read about anything we can get our hands on about what has gone on in the past. I discovered the Coaching Club had staged a number of long-distance drives, New York to Philadelphia, for example, New York to Saratoga, New York to via Saratoga to Shelburne, Vermont. And I decided it would be fun to recreate these. Now, when you drive a coach on a long distance, you have to change horses every 10 miles. That has led to some amazing statistics. There was a company called Butterfield that supplied the horses for the stagecoach routes in the West. One book I read suggested they had as many as 400,000 horses. Sounds ridiculous, but when you keep in mind there were many stagecoach routes and they had to change horses every 10 miles, both going and coming, you can see the complexity of staging these horses, the same way that they did with the Pony Express. Well, I took that on as a challenge. I was joined by other members, including Frolic Weymouth of your town here and others. And we drove from New York City 204 miles following the original route. And amazingly, we're able to duplicate much of the original route of 1891 and where they stayed, etc. And we arrived at Saratoga 4 days later and drove on the track at 4 o'clock, as we arrived, we each, at that point, hooked up our own coaches with our own horses. It was a fun event. I did it. I staged it initially because I thought it would be something fun to go from point A to point B. I totally misunderstood what would occur. Number one, the women only agreed to drive on the coach when their husband was driving. Starting the second day, not one lady got off that coach. There is something magical about going through the countryside. It is, you see things that you would never see from a car. I drove that route many times in planning it. And when I drove it with a coach, I discovered many things that I had never seen before. Some great sage said in a turn of the century book that a coach moves at the speed with which the mind can absorb. 10 miles an hour, and I tell you, there's a lot of truth to that. We asked no permission from anybody. We did have an escort in New York City because one of the whips was concerned about some of the poorer sections of New York, what the reaction would be. It turned out to be the opposite. We left the Knickerbocker Club at 7 a.m., and people on Park Avenue didn't even look up while they're walking their dogs. We got to Harlem, the church emptied out, and the people came to the street and applauded as we went through. We had our first lunch at a former home where the coaching club had lunch in 1891. Today it is a Sleepy Hollow Country Club. We stayed that night at Cold Springs Harbor, and literally in the house, which is now a bed and breakfast, next door to the house that the coaching club stayed, and so on and so forth all the way through. It was a wonderful trip. We enjoyed it. It rained one day. Mr. Seabrook told Liz and the rest of the ladies that this was a free Elizabeth Arden water treatment that they didn't have to pay $400 for. We actually had one hill coming called the Bear Valley Hill in New York State. And Jack Seabrook did just as they did in those days. We had a cock horse. We had five horses that helped the coach up that hill. It was so much fun, we decided to do it again, and we staged the drive then from New York City to Shelburne, Vermont. That trip was fascinating in that even in New York State, from Saratoga on, we were significantly on dirt roads. We discovered the original stagecoach road between Albany and Toronto, which was largely still a dirt road because it was built on the side of the hill, not at the top, not at the bottom where it might be wet. The main roads now go through the bottom and the top, and this old lane still exists. Now, when we got to Vermont, it was almost all of it was on dirt. That was 167 miles. We completed both all the trips so far without any hitches, no problems. I did have a kind of an educational moment. We used my coach from New York City to Saratoga Springs, and I was concerned about running out of these blocks, brake blocks on the coach. I had a set for each day, and there's a piece of wood with a piece of tire on it. And I sent one of the support people into this little town, Poughkeepsie, and I said, would you help me out and see if you can get this original set of blocks re-rubbered just in case? So he goes in there to a tire retreading type place and tries not to explain what he wants or why he wants it. He just wants them to get it done. And the older gentleman who owns this place kept asking him 100 questions and finally said, you got it all wrong. And this young chap says, what do you mean? He said, well, my father and grandfather re-rubbered these blocks many years for the coaches and carriages. And your rubber is not vulcanized. It's going to rub through in a day. And he was right. He vulcanized it, and that set of blocks is on my coach for probably 10 or 15 years thereafter. So, you know, here we are. We were all know-it-alls, and it didn't turn out to be that. The coaching and how I got into it is really strange because I was not the least bit involved in horses. I was not a very good sailor. I was not a very good skier, although I tried and raced and did both. And I was an active guy. But when I decided out of the blue to get a couple of horses, I had no experience. I didn't know how to buy a saddle. I didn't know anything. But very quickly, it became apparent that somewhere the Lord had blessed me and I knew a lot more about horses than I did about sailing and skiing. It was a natural sport for me. I didn't really seem to need the instruction booklet. Horses did what I asked. I have always broken up until this day. I'm getting a little older. I may not in the future, but I have broken all of my own horses and trained them whatever sport that I've been involved in. I'm an oddball in the sport of coaching. I drive thoroughbreds. I love them. I fox hunt them. We ride them, and sometimes back to back. We have a big coaching event down in Middleburg this weekend. I've got the ambassador, the English ambassador, coming out, and on Saturday we have one of our hunt trail rides that we will be taking three of our horses out on. I can't tell you. I wish I could explain as well as Shakespeare did, but the thrill of sitting up on a coach and having those four horses, which is not all the time, doing exactly what you want to do. You're holding all the reins in one hand. You got a lot of horsepower there. There's a lot of majesty with it. You've got a Hochhorn player in the back giving you a thrill. It is truly a thrilling event. But what I think that has really made it for me is that it is a connection to history. As you learn about coaching, you learn about a lot of the history. The reason the English drive on the left-hand side, the left-hand side of the road, is because we get on a horse, because a man carried his sword on his left, gets on from the left. Your reins are in your left, your sword hand is on the right. When they went to coaching, they needed a free hand for the break, so you sat on the right-hand side. So that's how they passed in England. Now, why do they do it differently in French? Well, France does everything differently, so that's obvious why they did it that way. But the why they do it that way in France is the coach horses were driven by postboys that rode the two horses. They obviously had to get on or got on from the left side, and thus they passed that way. It took me a long time to figure out why we drove on the side we did in America. Burke Abile, one of our experts in the Smithsonian Institute, is now retired, did not know. There are lots of theories, maybe because the Conestoga wagons were driven by walking in the middle of the road, which is a high, dry spot. Ford Museum didn't know. Turned out that at Williamsburg, we have a great coachman down there who is in charge of all animal husbandry. He's done a wonderful job. He's raised $5 million for their stable down there, Richard Nickel. And he was given a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, a legal intern. He says, now what in the world do I do in the stable with a legal intern? So he put it working at the books, the law books in Virginia, and discovered as early as 1855, towns started passing laws that required you to drive on the right-hand side of the road as an anti-British sentiment. So coaching is not only a challenge athletically, it is a lot of fun because of the history that you get. I was honored to be here tonight. Thank you very much.
Does anyone have any questions that they would like to ask? Yes.
I do want to ask you, first of all, what do you do with two horses? You really made me want to cry. I told you about this. What are second careers?
Second careers are riding. One of the things that I failed to mention is that we also fund therapeutic riding academies. And it's very, very interesting, but a child, a person who is disabled and can ride a horse gets a lot of medical benefits and emotional benefits from having this horse. And it's a wonderful thing. So there are many therapeutic riding academies. In addition, sometimes when you have a horse, a backyard horse, you might need a companion horse for that horse, and they will look to find a horse that they can use for that purpose. Excuse me?
Fox hunting.
Oh, fox hunting, jumping. Many times a horse that cannot make it on the flats at racing can be trained to be jumpers, and it's less, surprisingly, I understand, it's less strain on the horse's legs than it is running a flat race. So there are many other options for them. Yes?
You mentioned that Taylor Rogers married into the Shippen family. Was there a connection between that family with the first dean of the veterinary school, Russ Shippen?
I don't know, but there may have been, because Russ Shippen, the coach copper, was recruited by Fairman Rogers to be the dean. he had graduated from Penn with a medical degree. And Roger said to him, you know, if you go to France and get a veterinary degree from Alfred, I'll promise you can be dean when you come back. So they also rode together at Rose Tree. And so Fairman Roger was older, but it was clear that Russia and Heidekoper was his protege in many ways, and they have been, I guess, a relation as well in the convoluted and many layered relationships between old Philadelphia families. Yeah. Other questions? If there are no more questions, I'm going to turn you over to Lynn Farrington. Lynn and I curated this together, and she is in charge of printed books and has laid out a number of volumes from the collection upstairs for people to look at in the reading room.
Right, and we have a reception on the sixth floor that we'd like to invite all of you to, and then a chance to come into the reading room and look at a lot of Muybridge prints, but also we have one original glass negative. Actually, it's a positive, which shows how they laid out all the images for one of the printed plates. And we'd like to share that with you and a lot of other books, and including a new acquisition. So I want to welcome you to come up to the sixth floor, have a little bit of something to eat and drink, and take a look at some interesting items. Thank you.